How would you like to be called a fool or a sucker? I bet you wouldn't like it, would you? That feeling of being tricked, of having someone put one over on us, is unpleasant to say the least. And according to author Tess Wilkinson Ryan, we will do almost anything to avoid it. In her new book, Foolproof: How Fear of Playing the Sucker Shapes Our Lives and the Social Order and What We Can Do About It, Tess argues that our efforts to avoid being humiliated or exploited can explain much of our individual and collective behavior. And being aware of this, we can make better decisions. Tess teaches law at the University of Pennsylvania, and she joins us now to share five of her big ideas.
Hi, my name is Tess Wilkinson Ryan. I'm a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and most recently, I'm the author of the book Foolproof: How Fear of Playing the Sucker Shapes Ourselves and the Social Order and What We Can Do About It. And today I'm going to share with you five of the key insights from that book. Foolproof is about how much humans hate feeling suckered, when it's worth taking a risk of playing the fool, and why the whole thing matters for us as individuals and as a society. So insight number one is that the risk of being a sucker should be one consideration among many, but sometimes it takes up more space than it deserves, becoming a deal breaker rather than a minor risk. There are possibilities of being made a fool like all over the place. If I was inclined to be especially suspicious, I might see like a new grocery store in my neighborhood overcharging me, my colleagues trying to shunt their committee work onto me, even my kids exaggerating their needs. Day to day, there are little fool's games everywhere we look, and it's really natural to overreact to the risk of being suckered. One of the ways I want to think about that overreaction is by thinking about a study from a couple of psychologists at Stanford. Here's the gist. Imagine you've been given $100 and an opportunity to invest in a startup. This new startup has been assessed by experts, and this is what they tell you about the odds of success. They say, look, there's an 80% chance that this goes nowhere but doesn't totally tank, and you just get your money back. You break even. There's a 15% chance you're going to double your money, and there's a 5% chance you're going to lose everything. The participants in this study were randomized into two possible groups or conditions. Both conditions heard the basic setup, but then they each got a piece of extra context about that downside risk, that 5% risk of loss. In one group, they heard that the 5% risk of losing everything was because the founders of the company might have overestimated market demand for their product. In the other group, they heard that the 5% risk of losing everything was because the founders might be total frauds. So the question for the participants was, how much of your $100 would you invest if you had the opportunity? Now, the numbers were the same across conditions, but the nature of the downside risk turned out to be a big deal. The same people who might be willing to invest $60 in the normal market risk situation were only willing to invest $37 if the risk was a risk of fraud. They were much more risk averse if the 5% risk was the risk of fraud. There might be reasonable explanations for this, I guess. Like maybe I'm more embarrassed to be associated with a scam than I am to be associated with just a regular failed company. But most of the time, it seems to me that if I'm investing money in something, it's because I want to make more money. And financially, those two risks are equivalent. So my takeaway is that the study suggests people are underinvesting in that second company because of the quite small risk that they would be a sucker. So insight number one is don't let that fear of being a sucker swamp the rest of your personal cost-benefit analysis. Which leads me to insight number two, related to the first. And that's that the same way that sucker fears warn against personal investments or financial investments, they also warn against acts. They warn against acts of generosity. When people want to do good, they want to help or donate or contribute. One of the things that stops them is the concern that their charitable instincts are going to make them easy marks. This turns out to affect how people engage in charitable giving in a kind of upside-down way, where people who want to give money, want to be generous, end up making less valuable donations because they're trying to scam-proof their altruism. This is why, for example, it's sometimes easier to get donations that are in kind. So when you're trying to do a coat drive, coats for kids, get people to donate winter coats, or a Christmas gift drive, or cans of food, those things are easier to get people to donate oftentimes than donations of cash. And I think that's because cash feels like it could be exploited. It could be used for the wrong person or for the wrong reason in a way that, say, a can of beans just does not implicate. But one thing that food pantries, for example, often say is, please give us cash instead. Don't spend your time going to the store and your money paying retail prices for food. We buy in bulk, which saves transportation and product costs. And also, we, the food pantry, get more value for our money because we know what our clients need. We don't buy canned vegetables in a week when we know that the most pressing need in our community is baby formula. So we spend less for more valuable donations. This reminds me of a statistic that operates at the more systematic level, which is that almost 2/3 of Americans think that the government spends too little on assistance to the poor, but only 1/4 think that the government spends too little on welfare. There's a lot of reasons for this, but one that sociologists have noted for a long time is that welfare is associated mentally with people taking money when they could be working, like gaming the system, which means that some people who have the goal of helping people in financial dire straits, the prospect of feeling suckered sometimes steers those same people away from the means to the end that they actually wanted. So insight number 2 is fear of playing the sucker can interfere with our community or generosity in ways that conflict with our own overarching values and goals. Insight number 3 is that big scams are a big deal, but the little ones actually get more attention. Some scams I think are really obvious. I think we all get what Bernie Madoff was up to. It was a Ponzi scheme, no matter what we think about the psychology of feeling suckered. On the margins, though, it can often be easier to see the hustle from a person who's asking for bus fare, for example, than it is to see the hustle from the CEO of an investment bank. There's a reason that the archetypal grifters are more sort of marginal characters in myths and novels. Even though the stakes are higher when there's more money and power involved, people are more attuned to hustles from people on the margins. For a number of reasons, it's just easier and more intuitive to accuse people with less power of taking advantage, which is kind of perverse. And so I'll give you an example. When my sister was a medical resident, so she was in training to be a doctor, she and her peers worked incredibly hard, as all residents do. I was in total awe, and I was also kind of appalled at how relentless it was. Very impressed that they were all doing it and with such basically good cheer. Her program was in obstetrics and gynecology, and it was mostly women residents, which means that there were, say, 6 or 8 women in their 20s and 30s in this resident group, some of whom were also having children while they were at this stage in their training. And when they did have kids, they would take their very measly 6 weeks of leave. And when they did that, their co-residents would have to absorb the extra work. So then you have the situation where these new doctors are also new moms and they come back to work, and like lots of new moms, they deal with all the normal stuff that happens to parents of babies. Like you get daycare viruses, or your babysitter calls out one day, or you have to take breaks to pump, that kind of thing. This team of residents, the youngest people on the sort of hierarchy of physicians at the hospital, had to absorb the work of whoever was missing time. And you can probably imagine how easy it is for resentment to start bubbling up. It's so easy to craft a narrative about how a new parent is actually shirking, or they're getting special treatment, or they're playing the baby card. And for some reason, those complaints are more intuitive. They generate more instinctive indignation than the complaint that, hey, the hospital administrators could do a better job supporting these hardworking residents. I think that latter critique is the more important one. It goes to the sort of structural problems, but it's so much easier to reframe exploitative choices from institutions as choices that are made that are good for business. People seem to be naturally attuned to minor scams from those with less social capital to spend, but with people or institutional bodies with power do stuff that's arguably exploitative, so either underpaying workers or overworking staff, it's much more likely to be described in positive terms as savvy or cost-effective. So the third insight is, even if we know consciously that minor scams are minor deals, they make bigger waves psychologically than systematic exploitation. The fourth insight is that stereotypes about suckers and scammers are surprisingly common, and they're often deployed to undermine our capacity for empathy. There are times in our lives when we want to signal to each other that we are genuinely worried about something exploitative. I think this is what people are doing when we talk about big something. So if you talk about big tobacco or big pharma, you're trying to signal a distrust in some institution or group of institutions. But sometimes the warnings about who's scamming who are more subtle and I think more invidious. So this idea overall is an idea about stereotypes and the way that warnings about suckers and schemers are baked into some of the most potent and most offensive stereotypes, sometimes in a way where we know they're there, but we actually don't talk about it explicitly. If you flip through right now a mental catalog of racial and ethnic stereotypes, I bet you can spot these sucker warnings all over the place. As an example, I thought I'd give you a case from gender stereotyping that stuck with me as a teacher. So I used to teach a class in wills and trusts. And in this class, there are a lot of family disputes. So who challenges a will? Usually it's the family members who think that they deserve to inherit more than somebody else. And there's a recurrent pattern in these cases where the adult children of a deceased parent, usually in these cases, it's the father who's the deceased parent, because usually we're only arguing about the big money in cases in which the men have left a lot of money behind, in part just because of historical facts about who holds wealth. So typically, it's these adult children whose father has recently passed, and they are arguing to a court that their stepmother doesn't deserve her inheritance. And we're reading all these cases with this same pattern in them, and there winds up being a really offensive, implicit accusation that doesn't quite get said out loud. And the accusation is, the stepmother is a gold digger. In the U.S., this is specifically a stereotype about women most of the time, and usually women of limited means, so there's also a class component. When I started rereading cases with this gold digger stereotype in mind, I started to understand something new, which is that this implicit accusation that women who have been oftentimes in these long-term marriages or have been engaged in really intensive caretaking during some hard health times, the accusation that these women are actually gold diggers is just a manifestation of regular old sexism. It's a regular gender stereotyping, and it really changed the way I saw the cases and the way I taught them. Accusations that the stepmother in these cases is actually, quote unquote, a gold digger, that's a way of undermining claims to real connection, right? Undermining the love between two people or the relationships in a family, and claiming that the love is actually a front for a desire for money. And people are so acutely sensitive to even a hint that someone is a con artist that it really warps their perception of who deserves sympathy or help or respect. Even for those of us who would prefer not to let stereotypes about gender roles or class status affect our thinking, the implicit accusation is there. And if you don't face it head on, it can be hard to ignore it. So that's number four. There are a lot of suckers and a lot of schemers and prejudice, and you want to spot the stereotypes so you can choose not to buy in. Okay, and finally, insight number five, this distorting effect of sucker fears can be mitigated by focusing on affirmative goals and deep values. So this last insight is about how we are better able to avoid the pitfalls of sucker phobias by keeping our eyes on the prize, our eyes on the goals. My poor sister keeps getting used for my examples, but I'm going to go back to her because she told me the story and it was such a perfect example. So she lives in Vermont and now she is a regular doctor with regular doctor life, and she was out biking with her friends on the weekend. And she's a great athlete, but she has a full-time job, and some of her friends are really serious bikers, not just out there on weekends having fun. So she was on a relatively difficult ride. It was just on the border for her. Like, she was sort of struggling to keep up. And she and all her friends coasted into a little town with a general store. And she was so relieved because she was so hot and thirsty and genuinely getting nervous that she needed to rehydrate, like, ASAP. So they go into the store and she looks around and she realizes it's not a regular general store. It's a tourist trap. Or at least it's all sort of like Vermont cute, you know, aimed at New Yorkers, not Vermonters. And so she goes to get her Gatorade and she sees it's like double or triple the usual price. And she had this moment of thinking, I am not going to pay tourist prices for a Gatorade. What a racket. But then she stopped and took stock. And she thought her priorities were all askew. She thought to herself, I have a goal right now, and it's to be able to ride home with my friends and enjoy my weekend. I am so thirsty, I'm feeling lightheaded. A Gatorade would be worth literally $100 to me right now. Even if that did make me a sucker in some way, what do I care if this store gets the win this time? What I need is hydration. I know the example can feel a little trivial, but the principle works in deeper ways. What is the goal here? That's the guiding light. Imagine a student comes to me and asks for an extension because she's been sick. I can easily get distracted by whether or not the story has been verified or she's just trying to get more time because she's behind on her work. I could ask for doctor's notes or something. But what I hope I do is to keep my eye on my real goal as a professor, which in this case is modeling professional compassion, grace, right? Focusing on the goal of this interaction, letting the student, another human, know she has support in this institution, connecting with another person who's asked for help. So that's my last thing. What are your values? What are your goals? The answer to those questions tells you where to put your psychological energy. And with that, I'm done with my 5 insights from Foolproof. Thanks so much for listening.
Thank you, Tess. That was Tess Wilkinson-Ryan with 5 big ideas from Foolproof: how fear of playing the sucker shapes ourselves and the social order, and what we can do about it. I'm Rufus Griscom. Have a great day.